Isaiah 22 is tough to figure out what's going on. So we're going to read it, and then we're going to explain it, and I'll tell you too, our focus today is going to be a little less. Normally, the emphasis is on what, you know, what's he saying, and going through more verse by verse, and I'm going to move faster this time, and in that part, but as you'll see, there are some things that there's some historical background to, and so I brought in some pictures and stuff. So we'll spend a little bit of time just talking about some of those things. So let's, for reading, let's break it into maybe two parts, 25 verses altogether. So if somebody will take, let's do the first 14 verses. Kim, and then if another reader from 15, Vicki, you'll take 15 to the end. Go ahead.
Okay. The oracle came from the valley of the water. What is the matter with you now that you have all gone up to the housetops? You who are full of noise, you boisterous town, you filthy city, your slain were not slain with a sword, even if they die in battle. All your rulers have fled together and have been captured without the bow. All of you who were found were taken captive together, though they had fled far away. Therefore I say, turn your eyes away from me, let me weep bitterly. Do not try to comfort me concerning the destruction of the daughter of my people. For the Lord God of hosts has a day of panic, subjugation, and confusion in the valley of vision of breaking down the walls and destroying the mountains. And Elam took up the quiver with the chariot, infantry, and horsemen, and Kir uncovered the shield. Then your choicest valleys were full of chariots, and the horsemen took up fixed positions at the gate, and he renews the defense of Judah. In that day, you depended on the weapons of the house of the forest, and you saw that the breaches in the wall of the city of David were many, and you collected the waters of the lower pool. Then you counted the houses of Jerusalem, and you tore down houses to fortify the wall, and you made a reservoir between the two walls and the waters of the old pool. But you did not depend on him who made it, nor did you take into consideration him who planned it long ago. Therefore, in that day, the Lord God of hosts called you to weeping, to wailing, to shaving the head, and to wearing sackcloth. Instead, there is gaiety and gladness, killing of cattle and slaughtering of sheep, eating of meat and drinking of wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we may die. But the Lord of hosts reveals himself to me. Surely this iniquity shall not be forgiven you until you die, says the Lord God of hosts.
This is what the Lord Almighty, says. Go, say to this steward, to Shebna, who is in charge of the palace, what are you doing here? I gave you permission to cut out a grave for yourself here, hewing your grave on the height and choosing your resting place in the rock. Beware, the Lord is about to take firm hold of you and hurl you away, O you mighty man. He will roll you up tightly like a ball and throw you into a large country. There you will die, and there your splendid chariots will remain. You disgrace to your master's house. I will dispose you from your office, and you will be ousted from your position. In that day I will summon my servant, Malachim, son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him with your robe and fasten your sash around him, and hand your authority over to him. He will be a father to those who live in Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. I will place on his shoulders the key to the house of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I will drive him like a peg into a firm place. He will be a seat of honor for the house of his father. All the glory of his family will hang on him, its offspring and offshoots, all of its lesser vessels, from the bowls to all the jars. And that day, declares the Lord Almighty, the peg driven into the firm place will give way. It will be sheared off and will fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut down. The Lord has spoken.
Figure that out. It's kind of tough. I've quoted, cited, referenced this chapter in teaching for, well, since I began teaching a long time. But this was the week for me to like figure out like what's going on, and not to just quote this verse or. But I think I have a better handle on it. Although there's some specifics that are, if you press me on them, I'll just cry uncle. But there's some rich teaching as well. And I made an outline and I forgot to make copies of it. I was trying to, like, I got to get the remote from Jeff and turn in the library books and turn in our sweepstakes things. And I forgot.
Kelly wasn't here to back yet.
Yeah, Kelly's homesick.
You need it?
Well,
I'll make it,
do you know how to make copies here?
Yeah.
Okay, so
I won't say anything good while you're coming.
Nothing good about you.
Yeah, I normally, yeah, 20. Here's the first thing. Beginning in chapter 13, Isaiah gives a series of oracles. An oracle against Babylon. Remember, we spent a few weeks on that. An oracle against Moab. We skipped that one. An oracle against Philistia. An oracle against Egypt. That was last week. Oracle against... And the last one is the oracle against Tyre. There's one that doesn't fit. That doesn't belong in these oracles against foreign nations. And that's this one. Now, what is this talking about specifically? An oracle of what? Right, the Valley of Vision. What is that? That's the name of a book of Puritan prayers. It's really popular. I don't know if you have that. But and they probably got the title from this chapter, although in this context it doesn't mean what it means for that book. I don't think. I think it's speaking in a very negative sense. It is talking about Jerusalem. There's no real doubt about that, because the content of it, the city, it talks about the city of David and the house of Jerusalem, and so the Valley Vision is Jerusalem. But how? I don't know. One thought is, normally you think about Jerusalem as a hill, as a mountain, and the fact this is valley, maybe it's because of the judgment. What about the vision? Well, it maybe Isaiah's vision, maybe it's another possible translation is it's a valley of calamity. That would make sense. But I put the verses up here, not because we're going to go real slow through everything, but it kind of helps me to keep on track and kind of an order, and I will point out some things. Here's the outline, and this outline is on the handout that Tom will bring for us soon. The title of chapter 22, I've entitled it, what did I put it here? Judgment on Self-Reliant Judah. And it's going to be broken into two parts. Self-Reliant, the nation is the first part, what Kim read. The nation as a whole was looking to itself and not to God. And then the second half is judgment on individuals. So it goes from general to specific. And the sin of the nation is the sin of individuals. The sin of individuals is the sin of the nation. I think that's what's going on there. It is unique. It's different to single out, and by name, two different guys, Shebna and Eliakim. All these other oracles. Remember the king of the Babylon one? Never gave us a name. I mean, scholars spent all this time trying to figure out who it was, because he doesn't say. Here, he gives us the name of not one but two guys. I'm thinking this isn't the king. I mean, normally you think like you're going to go after the king. Doesn't say a word about the king here specifically. It's talking about his chief of staff. The ancient world, they called him the steward, the royal steward. But I think our closest equivalent might be chief of staff, right hand man. So that's the two parts. The first part, the destruction is coming. That's maybe the toughest part for me, the first eight verses. Some of that kind of goes back and forth. The second section is easier, and I'm going to give you more photographs for that. Jerusalem should have believed rather than built for their salvation. And then the second part Or, and then, well, here too, similar idea. Jerusalem should have repented rather than rejoiced. And then we're going to talk about the chief of staff. And for all of these, there's some interesting discoveries that you can see in Jerusalem today. And I mean, we can't. It takes too long to get there today. But I got pictures that I'll show you of some of them. So, just I'm going to make sure I move quickly here, and that may frustrate you, but we're going to miss something, so I'm going to try to choose what we miss. The Valley of Vision, I mentioned this point already. I think it's speaking about the judgment. The people are, they're partying here. They're really, they've gone up to the rooftops, and they're shouting, they're rejoicing. I don't know why. This is one of the mysteries of this chapter that I still can't answer for you. And I read a lot of theories. None of them are very satisfying to me. So I'm going to we're basically going to understand the truths without necessarily knowing, like, was there just a great victory? Or were they assuming there would be a great victory? Or were they just sort of ignoring reality? Because there's indicators of each of those. So I don't know which is right. When Isaiah gave it, it was very clear to everybody. But we're now distant from that. Because here in verses 2b and 3, it's talking about how the leaders, they ran away, and they were captured without even fighting. So that doesn't sound like a cause for rejoicing. Now, this is a photograph just to show you the idea we talked about. The can you see that well enough with the light on? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The this is Jerusalem. This is the ancient part of the city right here. The Dome of the Rock, where the temple used to be, is here. This is all hilly, right? This is the mountain. So to say, I have a prophecy about Jerusalem, the valley, is going to automatically kind of go like, something's not right here. I mean, I think he's trying to get their attention. Here's another picture. It's really mountainous, and there again, this is from the opposite direction. That's the where the temple was in the city of David. I'm going to talk about the city of David a little bit. Here's the Hinnom Valley right there. You've heard about Gehenna. But I think if you capture the chapter in a phrase, it's talking about Jerusalem's destruction. And that fits too in the context of chapters 13 to 23, right? It's the destruction of Babylon, the destruction of Moab, the destruction of Tyre. So it's the destruction of Jerusalem. But we have more specifics here, more historical references, that some of which we understand. But notice here now, Jerusalem's being attacked. Elam's one of the enemies. Kir is another enemy. And when it says here that, verse 7, that the valleys are full of chariots, that's full of the enemy chariots. Okay, so that's not a good thing. Now the valleys surround Jerusalem. This is another picture from an airplane of the city. Again, for reference here, the dome, golden dome for the temple. But the ancient city, well, can you see the walls of the city? This is called the Old City. It's not old. It's only 450 years old. So it's very new in the city's history. But the ancient city was roughly in the same place and a little bit further south. This is where the ancient city was here. And see the valley? This is the deep Hinnom Valley. And then over here there's the Kidron Valley. You're familiar with that from the Bible too. These are the valleys that are full of chariots. I think he's talking about, you know, it's a future prediction. They're going to be full of chariots. The armies are coming, and you're going to be destroyed. So it's not a nice picture if you live in Jerusalem. Now, how, and I don't know which verb tense here to use, how did Jerusalem respond? How will Jerusalem respond? If this is a future attack, is it saying, I don't know. But whether it's, you know, like Isaiah saying, this is the way you're going to respond, or this is the way you are responding in light of what is coming, maybe isn't the most important thing. Here's the whole passage, and then I'm going to go back and break it down and illustrate some of these points here. What are they doing? They're looking to their weapons of the house of the forest. I'll tell you what that is. And you saw that there's a lot of breaches in the city of David. Okay, you got a lot of holes in your fortification line. And you collected together waters. If you can have the best walls in the world. And if you don't have water, the siege will last 3 days. Mm-hmm. So they're getting ready. They're counting the houses of Jerusalem. I don't know what that means. There's something for it, but I don't know why they counted them. I can make a guess. But and you broke down the houses to fortify the wall. Okay, so that's clear. You made a reservoir between the two walls for the water. So it's all about how can we get ready for the attack? What can we do to strengthen ourselves, to prepare ourselves for the invasion? But here's the problem. Isaiah says, you did all this work, but you did not look to him who did it or see him who planned it long ago. This is very good Isaianic language. He likes to talk about God as the one who's planned it, the one who has known it, who is in charge of all. And so all this work, but all on the horizontal plane. No one's looking up. No one's looking to the one who has decreed it. So let's just go back. And here's where I said we're going to be a little bit more in with pictures. And maybe for this I'll just hit the light, since it will help some of these pictures. The house of the forest. What does it mean? He says, you look to the weapons of the house of the forest. What is the house of the forest? It's a reference to Solomon's palace. Solomon built, I know I forget the name, and I didn't have to take time to look it up. It's about 1 Kings 7, where it talks about the palace with the forest of Lebanon. So what is that? Here's a couple possibilities. This is we don't have any evidence of Solomon's palace because it's all been built and destroyed many times, so no archaeological discoveries there. But they found another temple in Syria and palace next to it. And the temple has a similar design to Jerusalem's temple, and the palace has a similar designed to palaces in Israel. So maybe this is what the Jerusalem temple looked like, and maybe this is what Solomon's palace looked like, and it's one of the best possibilities that we have. It could be that the palace was paneled with wood. It's called the Hall of the Forest because they had to cut down a forest to build it. Could be. Another possibility is that this Hall of the Forest was made like they did in Egypt. You had a room full of columns. And this is in Egypt. It's a very impressive effect. In fact, I would say, I mean, I said for a long time, would I still say it? I said it for a long time, so that's good enough. That this is the most impressive place I've been in terms of man-made building. Now, I know maybe it doesn't look like that, but this is a person down here. There's 140 of these columns, and it's like three people to stretch your arms around, and then it's all carved, and it goes up. You know, it's whether or not it's supposed to, you know, it's very overwhelming, and so that could be something similar to this that Solomon built, and in the days of Isaiah. They're looking to this, probably the place where they stored military equipment. As it says explicitly, you look to the weapons that are stored in the palace. And you saw that the breaches in the city of David were many. I don't have a picture of a wall that's fallen down. I mean, I didn't bring one anyway. What does it mean, the city of David? The city of David is one of the hills of Jerusalem. There's two hills in Jerusalem, and the eastern hill is this one right here. The temple's up on top, the Dome of the Rock today. This is where the city that David conquered. And so there was an old wall here, and that's probably why parts of it collapsed. It just hadn't been restored, repaired, and so that's, they're going to do that as part of their preparation. Now, you collected the waters of the lower pool. Now, I didn't look this up either. It's too many things. But in Isaiah 7, you remember that Isaiah takes his son and he goes up to meet King Ahaz at the upper pool. So we know there's an upper pool, there's a lower pool. We don't know where either of them are. But I'm going to guess that the upper pool is upper, like somewhere up here. And maybe in the valley, because the valley is a natural place for water to drain. This is a valley, by the way, right here. It's the central valley. Maybe the upper pool's up here, maybe the lower pool's down here, or down here, somewhere like that. So they're collecting the water, getting ready for the invasion. And you broke down the houses to fortify the wall. Now that may sound a little bit strange, like why would they do that? But it seems like there were houses in the way. The wall needed to go here. This is the natural path of the wall. And sorry, if your house is there, then we're just going to, what do they call that? Domain?
Eminent
domain. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like that.
It was also quick building materials, too.
That's right.
Quick building materials, and you know, you scavenge.
Yep. Now, archaeologists found in the 1970s in Jerusalem this wall. I should have somebody go lay down on it for scale, because it's bigger than it looks. That's about 25 feet wide, maybe 23 to 25 feet, and they found about 200 feet long of it, length of it. They call it the Broad Wall because of the size compared with, there is a wall in the Bible called the Broad Wall in Jerusalem, so they think maybe this is it. It is the largest wall ever found in Jerusalem from the Old Testament period. And they found, interestingly enough, right over here, some houses that were cut through when they built the wall. So I don't know for sure that this is exactly what Isaiah is thinking of, but it could be. Something could be the same time period, something similar. It's very interesting, at least. So when I bring students here, I usually mention Isaiah 22 in connection to these houses that were destroyed. One other thing that they did, they made a reservoir between the two walls. So, what two walls, what reservoir? Here's a guess. Here's the walls, as it was from the time of David and Solomon. And here's a wall. And then there's this valley here, which is a really nice place to build a pool. And in the days of Isaiah and Hezekiah, they built, remember this, the wall I just showed you, the broad wall? That was right here. Okay, that's this part here. But the wall wasn't just here. They didn't find it, but it went all the way around the hill. So probably between the two walls is between this wall and the new outer wall. So they built a pool between the two walls. And this right here is the area of what's known as the Pool of Siloam. Now we know about it from John, the blind man, washes off the mud. But that pool could well have, you know, existed 700 years early in the time of Hezekiah, and it could be this, the one that Isaiah is mentioning here. Now, where does that water come from? You built a pool between the two walls. This pool here is, there's no spring here. There's only one spring in Jerusalem, and it's up here. So what Hezekiah did, right? Hezekiah is, you know, contemporary with Isaiah. So this could be what he's talking about. You dug a tunnel. In order to get that, make this pool worthwhile, you made your tunnel underneath a mountain. And that would certainly fit in the context, the flow of this passage here, where the people are doing all this work, they're relying on themselves. Here's a picture of the city from the south, and of course the temple was up here. The city of David is this right here. The spring is on the slope right over here, the Gihon spring, and then Hezekiah dug this tunnel underneath the mountain to the other side of the hill, to the valley. And here's another picture of that, the spring on this with a circle around it, and then for some reason, nobody knows why, it doesn't go in a straight line, it snakes, curves around, but it does get out to the other side, and it supplies the pool of Siloam. You can walk through the tunnel today. It's 1,750 feet long. The water still runs through it from the spring out to the pool, and it's narrow. It's about a person wide. You can't pass inside, but you can walk. It takes about 30 minutes to walk through. There are some curves. There are some false turns where they start to go this way and realize, no, that's the wrong way. The water's about to the height of your knee today. It used to be more than 10 years ago. It'd come up to about mid chest height because the end was blocked up. It wasn't draining properly. But they've cleaned it out, and it's lowered a bit today.
The spring is called
the Gihon Spring. It's the only water source in Jerusalem, except for rain. Then you collect rainwater in your cisterns. So then the ceiling gets very high at the end, probably because they started too high, and then water only flows right downhill. So they said, well, we'll have to cut it down. So the water flowed down. So you can see here, it's probably, 20 feet or so high there.
It looks like it's almost
on the
rock.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely.
I took my kids through there. It was just, we didn't have a guide.
Did you get lost?
No, we made it through, but my daughter, because there's, it's claustrophobic. It's dark. And she was claustrophobic, and she started screaming about halfway through. There was no light. Just these little things. Yeah. And it's like, one step, come on, let's go.
Wow.
And it was an experience I will never forget. And the other two were okay, but the guy had said that there was two people digging towards each other, and they had a meet, and so that's why he reasoned that it was curvy like that, because it started at two ends and were kind of.
Yeah.
And they did meet.
They did.
Today was amazing, because, how did they? I couldn't figure out how to do it. It was scary.
We don't know.
This is the place where they met.
It is.
Well,
this is exactly where they met. This is, and you know it because in the tunnel you see the pick marks going this way, and you see the pick marks coming this way. So it's hard to get a good photo of it, but this is right here is where they broke through. And the curves, there are more curves where they met. Because, they're trying to figure out, okay.
I hear you.
Exactly. And there's something cool about that. I'll show you here in a second. But the Bible mentions this. Isaiah doesn't mention the tunnel, but it's mentioned in Kings, 2 Kings 20. It's also mentioned here in Chronicles. It says it was Hezekiah who blocked the upper outlet of the Gihon Spring and channeled the water down to the west side of the city of David. So there's no doubt that the tunnel that exists today is what the Bible is talking about. That's exactly what the Bible says.
Why did they not have a pool by the springs? Why did they want it on the other side?
Great question. The spring was low on the slope, and there wasn't a good way to protect it there. But by bringing it underneath the mountain, as it were, not under the were, under the mountain, they had that other wall, that second wall going around it, so it was now inside of the city.
So the spring is outside the city.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
okay.
If you couldn't build a wall around it very well because it would be so low.
Sloping.
Because it was down the slope.
Right. and just the shape of the terrain, so it's obviously it's and the slope of the tunnel, this is engineering, people, 1 foot decrease in elevation from start to finish. 1,750 feet distance, 12 inches down. And yeah, so it was, they could protect it on that other side. There was another wall that Hezekiah built, this wall over here, so now it was protected inside the city. Whereas here, exactly where that outlet was, and how it relates to this picture, but picture it being like flowing out here, and if you build a wall there, it's just too easy to, I mean, people can just stand right over here and shoot their arrows right over.
You know, just to finish this up, you know, they probably were concerned about disrupting the source if they tried building a lot in that area, I betcha, because, you know, they probably didn't have a good understanding of where the water came from, and, you know, it just collected in that area. They didn't want to disturb that. So by building the tunnel, they were able to route it to a place that they could do more with.
Yeah. That's a very good point. They built a big old pool,
yeah,
so it could collect it, and they had the space over there to do it, whereas you want to build a big pool for your enemies to come and drink out of. So, now, they found at the very end of the tunnel, the southern end of the tunnel, an inscription. It was found over 100 years ago. Now, it was vandals stole it. They broke it out and took it away. So today, all you can see is where it used to be, but it was recaptured by the authorities in 1881 and taken to a museum in Istanbul, Turkey, and you can see it on display there. It's hard to read it. Anybody read it? It's hard to even see the letters. That's my picture, but I have a better picture somebody else took. So you can see some of the letters here. Here's a translation of what it said. This is very interesting. When the tunnel was driven through, it breaks off at the beginning and at the end, but and this was the way in which it was cut through. So what we're getting here is the builder's inscription. This isn't the king saying, hey, look at me, how great I am. This is the builder saying, we did something really neat, we want to tell you about it, even though nobody will ever see this. This is the way it was cut through. Well, we're still axes, each man toward his fellow, while there were still 3 cubits, that's about 5 feet, to be cut through. We heard the voice of a man calling out, for there was, and there's a hard word here, we don't know what it means, an overlap, but something in the rock on the right. And when the tunnel was driven through, then the quarrymen were hewing the rock, each man toward his fellow. Again, we have coming from two sides. Axe against axe, and the water flowed from the spring toward the reservoir for 1,750 feet, and the height of the rock above was 150 feet. So this is an inscription from 700 BC describing the construction of the tunnel that brought the water. These guys were proud of their accomplishment. But the problem was, Isaiah is saying, is that all the people were proud of their accomplishment. And you did not look to him who did it or see him who planned it long ago. Jerusalem should have repented. This is what God desired. They should have been characterized by weeping and mourning. They should have been wearing sackcloth. But instead, they're partying. Let us eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Paul quotes that. In Corinthians, I think. So it's exactly upside down, they're inverted, what it should be. Their hearts should be stricken with grief over their sin, the recognition that they deserve the punishment. Maybe God would grant mercy, but instead they're just, you know, let's live it up today. Who knows about tomorrow, but we'll have a grand old time today. This is the conclusion here of this section. God's not going to forgive you for this sin. Now the second portion here, the judgment on the chief of staff, obviously we'll cover a little bit more quickly, this verses 15 through 25, is directed towards two individuals. Chief of staff A, and then his replacement B. Chief of staff A, he says, you're going to be removed, and I'm going to put chief of staff B in your place. We know this happens. Now I forget the reference, but it's in 2 Kings 18 or 2 Chronicles 30, somewhere in there, where it says that Shebna is no longer the royal, doesn't say he's no longer the royal steward, he's just something else. So apparently he had been chief of staff, and then he got bumped down to being, what, secretary of energy or something. But in Eliakim had, so Isaiah's words here will be fulfilled. Interesting what he's condemned for, out of all the things, this may be one that best illustrates his sin. He's condemned for building a tomb. Now, most people who died were buried in the ground, like most of us will be. Right? Dig a hole in the cemetery, throw us in, maybe, you know, we'll get a stone slab above us or something, but the real wealthy people, probably in our society, I don't know so much about our society, so I'll just talk about the ancient society. The ancient society, that's what you care about, don't know anyway, is the rich guys would build really fancy tombs. I didn't bring, could give you a whole tomb tour and show you all these cool tombs, but I'm not. I'm just going to show you that here's the city of Jerusalem, here's the city of David, the western hill over here, that pool, Hezekiah's tunnel. But the purple circles are where they found tombs from the Old Testament time. The nicest cemetery was right here, the best cemetery, and it dates from the time of a little before Hezekiah, a little after Hezekiah, so right at this time. Here is a picture looking, here's the city of David, the Gihon Spring is down here, I'm looking south. This is today an Arab neighborhood called Silwan, and inside Silwan, here it is, now I flipped around, this is now on the right side, there are a lot of ancient tombs. This is, so the people of Jerusalem lived over on this hill, they looked across and they saw the tombs here, and there were some nice ones. In fact, archaeologists have found 50, they've excavated, well they didn't really excavate it because people are living in them, some people's bedroom is an ancient tomb. But you can see, so a lot of them you can't see today, but some of them, right along here, you can see some holes. Yeah, here's one, but there's some other rocky belts. I got another picture. Here's a close-up. So these are tombs in here. This tomb may be the tomb of Shebna. This may be the same tomb that's mentioned in the Bible here. This is, of course, the doorway is modern, but the wood door is. But the doorway, there is an inscription here, there's an inscription here, there's another hole that was cut there, and then you could go inside. You can't today because it's locked, but...
Did you try the door?
No, no one lives in here, in this one right now. It's locked. But some other ones are just, like, just built a house in front of a cave. And the cave is just the back room of the house. And the slab where they laid the body is where today they have a mattress. And someone's sleeping there right now. Well, a few more hours will be bedtime.
Yeah, I don't know if we have time. I have two questions that I'm puzzling over. One, why do people, I know this is not part of the lesson, why do people cut the things off of the stone? I just know, are they valuable? Do they sell them to people?
Why do they
cut this?
Cut it into stones? Why do they steal them away?
Yeah, steal them away.
These ones were taken by the archaeologists to protect them. Because if they weren't, then they'd be gone.
Then they'd
be
gone.
I'll show you a picture of it in a minute here. But.
And the second thing is, I know that, you know, I don't live around, you know, 13,000 year old things. Why do people live in places that are considered tombed or that old? Is it just a cheap rent?
It's just, yeah, it's where they have a house and there's a tomb, there's a cave there, and I mean, just like you'd take advantage of things near your property.
It's too much control, you don't have to heat it or cool it.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's just where they live. And our society is so different because they're like, oh, I can get a better, cheaper rent over, you know, in this neighborhood, so I'll move and go over. They don't move. I mean, they like,
they're right there.
They tend to, you know, and then their kids mm-hmm. live in the same place. And
maybe it's like if somebody had a centennial farm, a farm that had been in the family for generations, and there was an old building in the back, and you're building a new house in front, you maybe attach it to the back. You built it right front, maybe destroy part of it, but it wouldn't matter because you'd have a little bit more space for maybe, you know, some tools or something. You don't care about the historical value, you just care about real estate space.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they're not caring at all about historical value, for sure.
And when did that happen? In other words, I guess what I'm wondering was that, when the Arabs lived in Israel, it was Palestine then that that happened?
That people are living there?
Yeah, that people took over that area. Because in other words...
The last 100, 200 years.
Okay, because the Jewish people have tried to preserve all of the historical places. But I was just curious if that's what that issue is, or since you mentioned that's where the Arabs were. Or, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just curious.
Some of the places... Many of the places that were populated in the Bible times mm-hmm. are so for a reason, like up high on a mountain, good water source, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why the people who are living there the last 1,000 years would tend to live in the same places.
Yeah.
So in Hebron, Shechem, Nablus, Jerusalem, all these, yeah, they're just... They're,
because in America, if there's someone has... a cemetery,
right.
They won't let you build on it. They move the cemetery. They won't move bodies, right. You know, and things like that. So I guess that's where I was coming from. I didn't know.
Yeah, there's a lot I can say about that, but
yeah.
I won't right now. there's an inscription, though. That's fine. I just we'll wrap this up here. The inscription from that tomb, it has a hole in it, of course. Somebody, you know, who knows how many centuries ago, decided they want to build a structure, a lean-to out in front of it. They needed their pole, you know, their ceiling roof support. So it knocked out part of the inscription, including the guy's name. This is the burial place of something Yahoo. Yahoo's kind of a common name ending. Like, you know, Jackson, or, you know, maybe the son part would be like a common. But it's this royal steward, this guy. There's no gold or silver here, but only the bones of him and his slave wife. The slave wife probably is an honorable term, actually. I should have changed the translation for our purposes here. But cursed be he whoever opens this.
They're just boys.
Boys.
Oh, there's an earthquake.
Yeah.
They're just opening the door.
So this could be Shebna's tomb that he built, you know, in a perfect, it's the best location, nice tomb carved out of the rock, and of course we know that tomb robbers can read. We know that they typically put gold and silver in tombs, or that they wouldn't say it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wrapping it up here. Shebna is going to be judged. He's going to be thrown out of the land. He's going to go into exile. He's got all these nice chariots. They're going to mean nothing to him. But he's going to be replaced by Eliakim. Eliakim's going to get Shebna's robe. He's going to get his sash. He's going to get his authority. And he's going to be a good leader. Eliakim's going to do a good job. And God says, I'm going to establish you. I'm going to make you like a tent peg. And then he kind of changes the image here because he sticks it in the wall. But all of this is positive about Eliakim. What he opens, none can shut. What he shuts, none can open. Sounds like New Testament there, Matthew 16 and also in Revelation. But all this is good, and that's why it's kind of strange then that it ends up with this verse saying, but even you will fall. So I don't know if it's because Eliakim is guilty. Maybe he like starts off good and then he goes bad. Or if he... maybe he's good, but his descendants are not. Those are a couple possibilities. I knew I would struggle with this time-wise and such today, so I tried to just put a nice summary of the whole on this page, so even if you didn't understand anything I said, this will make sense. So, let's close in prayer. Father, that was a lot of data and information and not as much application. You know how all of us need to apply the truths that are here, the truths of your sovereignty, of looking to you and trusting you, not only in the day of battle and in the day of distress, but every day, not exalting ourselves like Shebna did and taking care of our own interests instead of those that we should be serving. So we pray that you'll use these truths and that we'll be very ready to apply them. We maybe nothing new here, Lord, but the repetition is good to just reinforce in our minds to do what we know we should. And do again, pray for those who are sick, can't be with us, and thank you. Commit this week to you as well, in Jesus' name.
Amen. Remember the chili cook-off at 7:00.